This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Coming up on the program today, the week that was, so much to talk about, so little time. Also, farmers and construction workers and our collective mental health. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 10th day of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It's the end of week three, I think, check me on that, of the greater parts of this economy being shut down. And as we saw in the unemployment claims numbers, the damage is mounting even as political talk turns to reopening this economy. So here for five and a half minutes of live radio to look back and examine our Heather Long from The Washington Post, also Sudeep Reddy from Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Heather, let me start with you and the Federal Reserve Chair Powell, I guess, yesterday with that big move on getting more money into this economy, $2.3 trillion. He is done kidding around, is the impression I get.
He has come out firing every bazooka he's got really quickly. And the stock market loves it. People keep asking, why did the stock market rally 10% this week, even though we have 17 million people out of work? And a big part of that is the Federal Reserve keeps putting out massive amounts of money to backstop pretty much every part of the market. What's new this week is, for the first time ever, the Fed announced it is actually going to make direct loans to companies and to states and municipalities. So that's never happened before, and it tells you how cash-strapped and desperate for cash so many parts of the economy are.
All right, so we're going to get to the disconnect between the markets and the real economy, which Powell talks about a lot in his address, in his set of remarks yesterday, was the real economy. But Sudeep, talk to me for a second about the Congress of the United States, the representatives of the people, and where they are in this whole crisis.
They are mostly playing along. This is kind of remarkable to see. A decade ago and since then, have had some pretty brutal discussions about the philosophy of government intervening in the economy. And today, most of the discussions are about tactics. They're about how do you have the government intervening in the economy, not whether the government should intervene. And so you have Republican lawmakers who are trying to one-up each other in coming up with ways to inject more money into the economy. Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri is proposing that we just have the government just pay everybody, just like pour money in and pay everyone. Don't even worry about trying to route it through businesses, which actually is probably a cleaner way to do it, to just have the government do a total takeover of the economy for X number of months. The big problem is nobody knows what that X is.
Right. Good point. And it's the Hawley thing was really, really interesting. But Heather, I do wonder whether Congress appreciates the velocity with which things are happening.
Well, they're certainly trying to make things happen, but it's just not fast enough. When you have this many people, 17 million unemployed, who are trying to get these unemployment benefits. A lot of people I talk to, you know, they've called 100 times a day to try to get through to an office to get this aid and this relief. And 2 or 3 weeks later, they still haven't gotten their first check. Same thing with small businesses. I talked to a small business owner this week from Michigan, and he called the Small Business Administration to check up on where's his loan. And he was caller number 16,000 something on the phone. And so I think, you know, the government, in government terms, they're acting at warp speed, at light speed, if you will. Yeah. But for the real economy, we have never seen a deterioration this quick in like less than a month. And it just the money is not getting out fast enough.
Sudeep, as I said, political talk is starting to turn to, has turned to actually now for a week or two, the idea of reopening this government. Do you think it's possible to get things going again in stages, as some are talking about?
Yeah, it is possible for us to do what is called reopening the economy, but what that actually means is going to be really different in reality than just saying that it's happening. It's going to obviously happen slowly and deliberately. Most of Montana and Wyoming are going to come back a lot faster than most of New York and California. Mm. But like, what does it look like when you have restaurants being ordered that they have to have every other table empty? Maybe restaurant will have half of their seats, a third of their seats, mm-hmm. That they can actually fill. That's going to continue throughout the summer and maybe into the fall. And so when we talk about reopening the economy, there's a false sense that maybe it's like flipping a switch, and it's not. It's mm-hmm. like slowly releasing a valve and letting people come back in with masks on, wearing gloves like you've never seen before, and it will look like a very different system, and it's not going to inspire confidence in most people to have that slow process, but it's certainly better than where we are right now with everything shut down for the foreseeable next few weeks.
Yeah, there are stories to be done about definitions of terms and what that means. Heather Long, really quickly, and by really quickly, I mean like 30 seconds. The markets are looking at the economy and saying, I don't really care. The Fed's giving us $2 trillion. There's a disconnect here between Wall Street and the real economy, right?
There definitely is right now. The other thing is the market's looking about 6 months out, and it's starting to see some weird glimmer of hope in that idea of the zombie economy that we were just talking about, that what if it partially reopens? Well, at least there'll be some money flowing again. But of course, if you're a small business owner who might have 50% of tables filled and the rest of the restaurant empty, that's no consolation to you.
Heather Long at The Washington Post, Sudeep Reddy at Politico. Thanks, you two. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. All right. On Wall Street today, mercifully, things were closed. It was relaxing, even, not to have to keep an eye on the markets. But we will have some economic details for you when we do the numbers. For all the best of humanity that a crisis can bring out, the opposite is also sadly true. Some people just don't shine in times like these. You've heard perhaps of tip baiting. It's a thing, apparently, when an Instacart user tries to lure a shopper to accept the order with promises of a big tip, only to reduce or delete the tip entirely once the delivery has been made. Instacart says it's not a common practice, but gig workers have been calling on the company to stop it anyhow. And this is not, by the way, the first fight over in-app tipping on gig platforms. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
The base wages gig workers earn from platforms like Uber or Instacart can be really variable based on distances, the level of demand, and the mysterious algorithms set by the apps. That's why full-time LA food delivery driver Skylar Odd says tips are so important.
Tips are 50% of my income currently. And without those tips, I would be probably operating below poverty level.
So he pays close attention to the apps. Some platforms set a default tip, while others make it a choice to opt in. Michael Lin is a consumer behavior professor at Cornell.
What you ask for and how you ask for it can impact the amount that people leave.
Because the biggest factor in tipping is social pressure. In a restaurant, that comes from a physical person looking over your shoulder. But online, it can be built into the app.
The larger those kind of default options are, those who do tip leave a larger amount.
But there's a catch. As the ask gets bigger, a higher share of people will choose not to tip. They have a negative reaction to social pressure. And that sour taste is what gig platforms are hoping to avoid, says Ravi Dhar, a marketing professor at Yale.
Takes away the idea that the relationship is more transactional and people have a higher customer experience overall.
In theory, forcing users to think about a tip could make them less likely to use the service. All that being said, delivery driver Skylar Odd points out there's another big variable he's been pleasantly surprised by lately.
Oh my gosh, people have just been incredible. I've had many, many, many generous tips, a lot of them over $100 for a simple grocery run.
And a tweak of the app wasn't even needed. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We're seeing as this virus progresses, and we'll keep on seeing as the curve makes its way through this economy, some of the cracks in the foundation. We've been talking about that a little bit the past couple of weeks. Today, transportation, specifically big rig truck drivers. We needed tens of thousands of drivers even before the virus hit. Now the industry is worried the shortage is going to get even worse in the age of coronavirus. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
Dylan Francis in Kansas City is ready to get out on the road. He has a job as a commercial truck driver waiting for him once he gets his commercial driver's license. But the Missouri DMV is closed indefinitely.
I want to be out there doing something. You know, this was supposed to be a means of not just resource for my family, but, you know, providing resources to the country.
DMVs are shut down in 27 states, and that's not the only holdup for the trucking industry. Commercial driver training schools are also shut down. Don LaFave, CEO of the Commercial Vehicle Training Association, says he's worried. When recovery efforts start, commercial truck drivers will be needed more than ever. And there's a big backup when it comes to training new drivers.
You don't flick a light switch and produce a driver overnight. We're talking upwards of 3 months to get that driver trained.
And that's just for a basic commercial license. Some drivers require additional training. Andrew Novakovich teaches agricultural economics at Cornell University.
In some aspects of general freight, one driver can go in and out of a truck, and you can, if you've got a CDL and it's the right class, you're in business. But in certain parts of the food industry, it's not so straightforward.
The Commercial Vehicle Training Association, along with several major trucking associations, have sent a letter to governors asking them to declare driving schools and DMVs essential services and reopen them. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
There's been a stay-at-home order in effect here in California for a bit more than 3 weeks now. But same as everywhere else, there are still lots of people going out to work every day. Healthcare workers, grocery store employees, clearly essential categories. Also, construction crews. Rocio Montano is an apprentice carpenter here in Los Angeles. She is one of the 10 people we're profiling in our series about the American labor force. It's called The United States of Work. As of right now, she tells us, her job site downtown is still open. She sent us this.
I feel thankful that I at least get to work and get to get my paycheck still. But it is kind of also a little scary going to work. I want to say quieter because people are more separate. There's less interactions. During breaks and lunches, we're all like spread out. And now we have hand sanitizing stations, kind of stay clean. Well, as clean as you can, since it is, you know, construction site. But they're really trying to keep us all safe while working. In the afternoon, when I get out, the city seems so sad and so quiet. Even the traffic isn't there. Like, what LA is known for, the LA traffic, it's all just gone. What does worry me is I live with my mom, and she does take public transportation to work, and she does work in a fast food restaurant. I think that even if we are aware, we can't say the same for the people all around us.
That was Rocio Montano. She's an apprentice stage 3 on the drywall team at a construction site in downtown LA from our series, The United States of Work. The earlier work that we did introducing you to all 10 people in that series is at marketplace.org. Also online, a chance to sign up for our newsletters, one for every show we do, marketplace.org/newsletters. Coming up,
I was willing to take the risk that I'm not going to get paid for all of this.
The business of mental health right now can be a bit of a gamble, but first, let's do the numbers. All right, so here you go. Equities were closed for Good Friday today. Bond and commodities closed as well. But for the short market week that ended yesterday, the Dow and the S&P 500 both up more than 12%. The NASDAQ climbed more than 10%. And although markets are closed, the Bureau of Labor Statistics did release some numbers today. Consumer prices fell 0.4% in March. That reflected big energy and travel cost declines as we all shelter in place because of COVID. That's the biggest monthly decline since January of 2015. But it is not, repeat, not, if you were listening to the program the last couple of days, it is not deflation. Some prices did go up. Cost of medical care, surprise, up 0.4% in March. Hospital services up 0.4%. Cost of physician services up 0.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A lot of farmers came into this year at least moderately hopeful. There was that phase one trade deal with China. Markets were in theory going to open back up. And then, of course, they didn't. Brian Duncan is the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. He is also a farmer himself, hogs and corn and soybeans. And he's one of our regulars, so we got him back on the phone. Mr. Duncan, welcome back.
Hey, Kai. Good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you. First things first, in these very strange times, how are you?
Well, we're healthy. We're doing well. Spring field work started. The livestock's all being well taken care of. So from that perspective, things are good out here on the farm. Economically, it's becoming quite challenging. So, you know, we've got different levels that we're worrying about things on, I guess.
Well, let's break a couple of those down. I mean, who's asking for your product right now, right? I mean, the hogs are growing and the plants and the corn and all that is growing, but is there demand?
Well, that's the problem. You know, our customers are under quarantine right now, and we've just seen demand fall off a cliff here. And you know, I like to be upbeat.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, it's hard to find the pony in this one right now.
With falling demand, of course, comes falling prices. So my guess would be that, and put on your Illinois Farm Bureau hat here for a minute, even those agricultural producers who are able to sell things aren't getting the prices they need.
Right. And a lot of us that produce perishable commodities that, you know, can't store and wait this out. I was actually on a conference call yesterday in which farmers were trying to figure out the nutrient value of milk to spread on their farm for fertilizer. So wow. It's right. And again, drastic measures, things are pretty scary, but we need a cohesive strategy to open things back up and try to get some economic normalcy going again.
Well, let me get there in just a minute, but I want to get back to agricultural America, sort of economically speaking, because it always runs really thin margins. You know, you got to deal with weather, and we just got through a trade war, and which is still going on, by the way, and all of that. And I guess really the question is, we talk a lot about this economy looking different on the other side of this virus. What do you think agricultural America looks like on the other side of this virus?
You know, that's a scary question, because tell me what consumers' habits are going to be like on the other side of this virus, and I'll tell you what agriculture looks like. Yeah. Are people going to go back to restaurants? I mean, so much of our business, and especially the high-value products, go through food service. And so, Kai, I think a lot of it's going to be dependent on how the American public responds.
So you are, in addition to a spokesman for the Illinois Farm Bureau on this program, you're a farmer, too. How's it going for you? I mean, how much of a hit are you going to take, do you think?
Well, yeah, it's real. When we were selling, just on a rough estimate, semi-loads of hogs prior to the outbreak for $25,000 a load, and I was just doing calculations this morning on some bookkeeping, we're down below $14,000 a load, and you know, we sell 13, 14 semi-loads a week, so you can pretty rapidly do the math and see what kind of effect it's having, not only on my family farm, but it's just the reality that we're facing right now.
Last thing, the thing you wanted to talk about. As you know, reopening this economy has become a politicized issue. It's contentious. Various different people have various different points of view. You think rural America is a little bit different?
Well, I think we've got to decide what's an acceptable level of risk. And as I'm out here in rural America, we have counties that have cases that you can number in the single digits, and yet all our small businesses are closed. And I'm no epidemiologist, all right? You know me, I'm a hog farmer from Ogle County, Illinois, but it would seem to me we need to start strategically thinking about how we open up sections and get people back to work, because I think the effects, the long-term effects of this shutdown could be health-wise more catastrophic than maybe the effects of the virus could be. I mean, Kai, you want to talk about how many illnesses are stress-related? I guarantee you there's a lot of farmers right now feeling a lot of stress, and I don't want to make light of the virus. I just think there becomes a point where we've got to measure what's acceptable risk and start thinking differently about how we maybe protect our most vulnerable citizens.
Brian Duncan, farmer, also the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Mr. Duncan, thanks for your time, sir. It's always good to talk to you. Stay safe, would you?
Yeah, Kai, I promise I'll be in a better mood next time we talk.
Well, you know, the news is what the news is, man, right?
Thanks, Kai.
Along with virtually every other part of this economy that can, mental health professionals are working from home. Therapy on Zoom or on the phone, right? This shift to mental telehealth, if you want the buzzword, means millions of people will continue to get care. But like so many things in this pandemic, the speed and scale of the change has turned an industry upside down. In this case, the insurance industry, which is scrambling to figure out what to cover and how. From Minnesota Public Radio, Elisa Roth reports.
This is the call Jenna Lindgren is making over and over these days.
Yes, I am checking to see if telehealth is covered through our client's policy.
Lindgren works for a company that does billing for mental health practices, and she's trying to figure out if the patient's health insurance will pay for telehealth now that the therapist isn't seeing patients in person anymore.
It'll be outpatient mental health.
It's relatively simple to translate therapy and other mental health care to a telehealth model, but whether it's covered by insurance is a whole other question. Paul Jonas runs the company Lindgren works for. The rules have been changing almost by the day.
We call the provider services line, and sometimes we're told one thing, sometimes we're told another. Clients are having this happen, too.
Health insurance is, well, complicated. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is a federal agency, sets the basic rules for public health insurance. Private insurers generally follow the government's lead, and then on top of that, they can also set their own rules. So here's an example. Until last month, the government was very strict about which technology could be used for telehealth. Phones weren't allowed. Therapy had to be done via special, approved internet platforms. Now the government says therapy over any phone is okay, which is a big deal because some people don't have a smartphone or a computer. But now the private companies have to decide if they'll cover therapy on the phone and under what circumstances and for which plans.
How will the group practice or the provider be working?
Pamela Greenberg is president of the Association for Behavioral Health and Wellness, which is a trade organization that represents health plans.
And then you can determine whether or not that seems like, yes, that makes sense. That should work via the service that you're using.
Greenberg says the other challenge for insurance companies is to make sure the clinicians are actually delivering the services they promise and that patients are still getting the care they need, even from a distance. Still, the switch to telehealth may turn out to be just the push behavioral health care needs. Hayden Huskamp studies health insurance policy at Harvard.
This could really be a game changer for psychiatric practice going forward. And so there may be a push for insurers to keep covering telemedicine for mental health care after this crisis ends.
In the meantime, though, patients and their mental health care providers may not know if treatment will be covered. Jim Jonas is the father of Paul Jonas, the man who runs the billing service. The senior Jonas is a therapist who runs a mental health practice in the Twin Cities. This family knows mental health care. Jonas says for now, at least, he's taking the gamble.
I was willing to take the risk that I'm not going to get paid for all of this. And I'm still probably not going to get paid for all of this, but I can sleep at night, okay, knowing that, you know, I checked in with my clients.
Therapists and psychiatrists are just starting to submit their March bills, which means they'll know in the coming weeks which ones are paid and which ones are rejected. In the Twin Cities, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which we could file under either the Tech is Amazing tab or What Could Possibly Go Wrong. Apple and Google made an announcement today. They are working on a joint project that will eventually add coronavirus contact tracing capability to their respective mobile operating systems. That is, a user tests positive for COVID. He or she adds that to their profile on a health app on their phone. The phone will be able to trace the contacts that person has had with other people over, say, the past 14 days, which would be cool. It will be opt-in, which is good, but it's also a means potentially to monitor the movements of something like 2 billion people on this planet, quite possibly more. All right, we got to go. Markets were closed for Good Friday. Stocks, bonds, commodities, the whole smash. But for the short week that was, down the S&P 500, up both more than 12%. The NASDAQ climbed more than 10%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of News. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. Stay safe. Wash your hands, please. We will see you again. Wear a face mask, by the way, if you go out. We'll see you again on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.